From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made each time a parent searches for affordable and reliable child care options, either at a daycare center, at home, or with a trusted friend or family member. According to new research from the Children's Agenda, there's a growing shortage of these services both locally and nationally, with some advocates calling the issue a crisis. Even when parents are able to find placements for their kids, the costs rival those of mortgage payments. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the average annual cost for infant care in New York State is more than $15,000. That's about 22% of a median family income of around $69,000. But what about families who make less than that, significantly less? What about families with single-parent households or those who live in poverty? The report released this week by the Children's Agenda shows how the shortage is playing out in Rochester. While the city has seen improvements in the availability of care for children in pre-K, options for infants and toddlers are increasingly hard to find. So what can be done to alleviate that issue? What is the impact on parents, on kids, and on the economy? This hour, we discuss the report and the Children's Agenda priorities, including a call for universal child care programs. We're also going to hear from providers and from parents who share the challenges they have faced finding services, especially those they can afford and those that are of high quality. I'd like to welcome our guest. The Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda is Pete Nabosny, back with us. Thank you, Pete. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Bridget Shumway, the President of Generations Child Care. Bridget, welcome. Tell us a little bit about what Generations does.
Thank you, Evan, and thanks for having me back. Generations is a licensed, nationally accredited child care provider in the Rochester area. We have six locations, and we serve children from infants all the way through school age. We also have a high number of those subsidized children you were just speaking of, so are well aware of some of the struggles that our families face with the cost of care.
All right. Thank you for being here. Also with us is Sarah Espy, who is the mother of a toddler. We have no time, so we're just shortening mother of a toddler to a
muddler.
Absolutely. Which kind of feels weirdly correct, doesn't it?
It does.
2.5 is your child.
Correct, yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you
for being here. Katie Guti is the mother of two. Kids are 2 and 5. Welcome, Katie. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Rosa Marie Curtis is mother of 2, 6, and 2, and president of Marvelous Mind Academy, which we will talk about in just a moment. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Pete, we're here for obvious reasons. I mean, we can dig into the data, and that matters because it paints a very specific picture of where the trends are, what the challenges are. But generally speaking, listeners know the daycare, childcare, I mean, it is really, really hard. So are we in a unique moment? I mean, is this sort of like trending upwards? Where are we historically, you think?
Well, certainly childcare has gotten more expensive over the last several years, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, rising costs of staff, employees, and things like that. But what this report really tried to focus on was the trend over the last 7 years or so, where we were able to get data which looks at what's available in this community in Rochester and Monroe County as far as care options for kids at different ages. And what we found was that there's really considerable declines in care for children birth to age 3, as well as care in that people offer in their home. So someone, you know, who they open a child care program out of their home, they're licensed, they're regulated, they're inspected to do that kind of care. Both of those two things have declined by about 25% in the city of Rochester over the last 7 years. And that's really made it increasingly difficult for families to find care for extremely young children. And that's also the most expensive kind of care. So that's really challenging for parents. On the bright side, as you mentioned, we've seen some growth in care for kids who are 3 and 4, you know, pre-K age kids, a lot of which seems to be related to expansions in state-funded pre-K in this community. And that's great, except, you know, expanding pre-K alone isn't the answer. Mm-hmm. Kids and families need care at different ages. They need care at different times. Pre-K is only open about 180 days a year. You know, parents working many more days than that. So, we're seeing this constriction of available care options for parents, which, you know, has all sorts of consequences down the road, whether it's a parent leaving the workforce, having to struggle to piece together care day to day, or just really having that uncertainty in terms of where their children can go and receive nurturing care that the parent's comfortable with, that they can afford, that's accessible, that's near where they live and work. And so It's a growing challenge in this community. It's not unique to this community, but we really wanted to highlight what's happening in Rochester here to have a call to action and see what we can do to improve it.
So we'll talk a little later this hour about the specific recommendations, but Pete, generally speaking, do you have confidence that policymakers are listening and are open to these ideas?
I've actually been pretty pleased at the response to this report, and I think that the issue of childcare has really actually emerged over the last couple of years as, you know, and policymakers are recognizing this is a real concern. I mean, the fact that care for an infant in this community is far more than tuition to a SUNY school, parents who are still pretty early on in their trajectory in their careers. You know, they may have student loans. They're really struggling to do things like get a mortgage, and childcare is one additional cost that can really impact someone's ability to be financially secure. And for low-income folks, it's a real challenge to stay in the workforce and kind of advance professionally and get more economic security. So I think policymakers are listening. What we haven't seen yet, particularly from the governor's state of the state and, you know, in some other areas is real action, real investment, you know, a down payment on moving towards something like universal child care, which is what we want to see. We need to see the policies and the funding priorities match the growing recognition of this challenge that communities face.
I think the stories from some of our guests are going to be instructive, and I'm going to start with Rosa Marie, who is a mother of two, who are 6 and 2. Can we mention their names?
Yes.
Mason and Maxon.
That's right.
I love those names. Mason's 6, Maxon's 2. Let's go back to when Mason was born. I know you were having trouble finding childcare for Mason. Obviously, the issue was affordability. Tell us at the time what your work situation was and what you were trying to do.
Yeah, so at the time that Mason was born, I was working at the University of Rochester as a pharmaceutical technician. I worked there. I did overnights, and when we got mandated, we had to stay, whether that was for weather or what have you. But then that impacted my family at the time, which was my sister-in-laws were caring for my son, and they were, 13 at the time, 14. So them along with their brother, and then coupled in with that was my grandmother. And so when I would get mandated at work, their lives would have to shift and move. And then at one point in time, my grandfather got ill. And when he became ill, my grandmother's primary responsibility became him. So I lost the anchor in my child care ship, if you will. And so I had to start searching and asking for who can watch my child primarily. And when I started this search, I mean, I started looking at daycare centers because you want the high quality, you want the accreditations because you feel that that's the best place for your child. But then when you look at the costs associated with each of those, you're upwards of $200. A week. And I wasn't bringing that home. And I believe at the time I may have been making like $11 an hour. So I then gracefully got a job at a childcare, an in-home daycare. And the woman there, she allowed me to bring my son. But even then it was a temporary situation because I was taking up a spot. So it was, okay, well, what are we going to do? In term, between the time that this daycare provider said, okay, hey, Rosa, you're kind of approaching your length of stay here with Mason, I reached out to my aunt who lived out in West Henrietta, and I was working on South Clinton. So I had to drive in the morning from Chi-Lai at the time to West Henrietta to work on South Clinton. And that was just, it just was way too challenging. It was not conveniently located, not necessarily even the most affordable, even though it was family, it wasn't free. So even with all those challenges, I realized that, you know what? There's a solution to this, and it's not out here yet. And so that's when Marvelous Mind Academy started to evolve, because I needed a solution that was, A, going to help me be a present parent, because I didn't want to be the taxi driver for my child. And I also knew that quitting work and not having a source of income wasn't a solution for me, and it wasn't going to help me propel towards my goals. So I started to create this. It started out as a project born out of a mother's frustration, and that's how Marvelous Mind Academy was born.
When did you launch Marvelous Mind Academy?
So we officially incorporated in 2014.
Okay.
Yes.
And where are you located?
Well, we've been mobile for the last 5 years. So we've worked out of libraries, worked out of the Rochester Museum and Science Center, and we literally just picked up the keys 2 days ago to our facility in Village Gate. So we will be planting our roots in NODA, So we're excited about that for sure.
And tell me about how it works and how many people you're working with right now.
So at the center, we are launching a service called Bridge Care, and that grand opening is not until Easter Sunday. So at that facility, we are able to care for children for up to 3 hours. The service that is called Bridge Care, it's member-based. So our members get access to child care day or night. At a moment's notice, we're open from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., and they can get up to 3 hours of care every single day. This is the care that parents need when, hey, I gotta work late. I'm gonna have somebody drop them off. As soon as I get out, I'll pick them up. This is the, hey, I wanna pick up this shift. I'm gonna drop them off. Hey, Dad, can you pick them up? You know, when on your way home from work. This is, I need to take a nap because I haven't slept. I need a break. I want to have date night. I don't want to play tag with my spouse. You know, hey, can you watch the kids tonight so I can go out and the next night you can go out? No, like we need time. That parental mental health is essential. So that is the service that we're providing at Village Gate.
Okay. And so with that Bridge Care idea.
Bridge Care. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you're doing what you can in your part in society, but you still need these structural societal changes? I mean, how do you view your place in all of this?
So, okay, twofold.
Yeah.
As a mom, right? My place in all of this is to ensure that my children have a place that they are loved, that they can learn and grow and still be present for them, right? And have all their needs met. As a provider, my place in this is to get the word out. So like as soon as I heard that there was no mention in the state of the state about childcare, immediately I went right to social media, right? Because the power is with the people. So I use my platform to help spread the mission and use that as a way to get parents and get this information in front of parents and say, hey, parents, this is about you. Right. This directly affects us. It affects our income. It affects how we live, how we work, how we take care of our kids. So that's my role in all of this. And yes, you're absolutely right, Evan. Like I'm doing my part and my little itty bitty part is what I'm doing. Right. To move the needle forward. And all of us working collectively together is going to make that happen on a grander scale.
What a story. Let me turn to Katie Gucci, who's the mother of two.
Hi.
Two and five, they are.
Two and five.
And, you know, yes. we interacted a little on social media, and you were kind of just sharing briefly about some of the challenges you have faced. So take me through your story.
Listening to Rosa, to have something like that would have been extremely helpful this time last year. So I have worked part-time since I've had children, and even finding part-time care seemed even more difficult to me than finding full-time care. My husband works in direct care, and he does not have a typical regular 9-to-5 schedule. And we thought we were being smart by working it out in a way that we would only need childcare 2 or 3 days a week. It's actually a lot more expensive. It's almost impossible to find a part-time placement in a childcare center. So our solution was to find a private care person to come to our home. Doing that was really difficult to find someone that was affordable. At one point, I was making about $17 an hour, and all of the private care people that I were finding wanted $15 an hour. So was that worth it for me to even go to work to bring home after taxes, like, you know, a buck an hour? Not really. Then I had people that were affordable, but they were not reliable. They were not quality care. I didn't want my children to be in their care. If I could have had something like that Bridge Care where, I have to be at work by 1 o'clock. My husband's done at 2:30. What do I do for that small period of time? That would have been a perfect solution. So as a parent, I'm very excited to hear that. and then, like what you mentioned for date night and just tag teaming, my husband and I have not gone out together since October.
Wow.
So that's something, too, that, again, we would be very excited for. Just to have 3 hours to even just go get a coffee together and talk about anything other than children would be phenomenal.
Where are you in your mindset about your own work now going forward?
I would love to work. right now. The problem that I'm finding is finding an employer that is flexible with our needs. And I understand, you know, as an employer, you need to meet your business needs. I completely understand that. But as a working mother, my children are going to come first. And I'm not going to change that. So to find an employer that has the flexibility and the understanding of, okay, it's 5 o'clock, I need to walk out that door. Sorry if this project isn't done, and I understand it would only take 20 more minutes. I don't have those 20 minutes. I need to go home. That's really hard and difficult to find. So in my job search now, I'm being extremely picky, which is taking longer for me to find employment, because I want them to know and understand right off the bat, my children are going to come first. Which brings me to another, like even finding childcare to go on interviews. Again, bridge care would be perfect for that. Yeah, I'm really excited about that, if you can't tell.
We definitely get that. Sarah Espy is the mother of a toddler who's 2.5.
Yes.
Tell us about your story.
So I have had my daughter in childcare since she was 6 weeks old. My previous job that I had been at for about 5 years was pretty well paying. So I was able to, you know, afford childcare, keep her in there full time. And that was wonderful. Last year I had my job took a turn and they cut my position. So I left and I did come into a new job, which was a lot less paying than I was anticipated. And we were a double income family at the time. And, you know, finding childcare that I could afford was really, really hard. I did qualify for subsidy, and that was wonderful because then, you know, I could choose where she could go that accepted subsidies, that allowed for full-time care. I was working full-time, and that was great. Her father lost his job. I lose the subsidy because they believe that she should be in his care there. That doesn't allow for him to look for a job. He did come into a part-time job, and that his hours are, say, 12 to 5 every day. They still don't always allow for, and I'm sure Bridget could speak about that a little bit, the subsidy might not pay for her to be full-time because he's still able to be in care. But what happens with this is my daughter's been in care since she was 6 weeks old. She's used to a social, emotional environment, the educational environment, being around children. Her development has progressed so much with having her in care for all of these years, and I've been so grateful for that. So it puts me in a position that has to decide, you know, do I pull her out of a quality care situation because I cannot afford this as a single parent, essentially on one income, because my father or her father and I aren't together at the time. And does this allow for me to be able to have her in the child care? So it puts me in a position to question whether I can work, which is always a difficult position. And it also puts me in the position to decide, should I pull my daughter out of care that I love? She's in a wonderful place. She has wonderful friends. She has a wonderful teacher. I see her grow every day. And like I said, she's been in care for 6 weeks. So for her to be home with me, that's going to be a huge social and emotional adjustment for both of us. So, you know, I think the subsidies are great, but it's been wonderful while I've been allowed to use it. But I think it's difficult to continue to use something or not have something to use in situations like this and how it can get pulled from you.
How easy or not is it to understand what subsidies are available to you?
I would say it took a lot to understand what subsidies are available. I don't think it's really clear on what is available all the time. It was made available by the childcare facility she does go to. They, you know, they give you a list of what subsidies are available. They have the applications on hand. So I don't think that happens at every facility, but I think that when you go online to look, it is not very clear on where you can apply. I know when her father was working, I did qualify for something, a different subsidy than just the standard DHS. So that I didn't even know was available, which sets a higher income to become approved, which was great. So that's why, and that's what I did qualify for, because it was a two-income household. And so that was great. And I didn't know that was available until the child care facility that she's currently at made it known that it was available. So by just going online and looking, I mean, I've Googled Monroe County DHS and for child care income eligibility things, and it does not make it clear the different. There's, I guess, I think like three or four different subsidies that you can apply for, and I always assumed that there was one.
All right, so before I turn to Bridget Chumley for her view on this as president of Generations Child Care, actually let me ask all three parents we've just talked to. What's on your menu, the top of the menu of needs or your desires for either improving child care options, clarifying, et cetera, going forward? What do you need most right now?
Affordable child care, essentially. I mean, I love the place my daughter's at, so I can't really think of anything specific.
But is that in the form of subsidy? Is that in...
Subsidy. I think the subsidy needs, because, I mean, to lose the subsidy just because... all of a sudden a parent becomes available to work, I mean, or to watch her, I mean, he can't essentially look for a job. Now, they're saying he stays home, doesn't need to have a job, whereas him having an income provides for our family. So it's catch-22 when it comes down to what we're looking for.
Got it. Okay. Katie, what's at the top of your list of needs or desires going forward as you think about child care?
Definitely clarity on those subsidies. I was in the same position, and I, after a 3-hour phone call, I finally figured out what I was able to apply for. And not only just the clarity of the subsidies, but then having that subsidy, finding a place that has a part-time opening that will accept those subsidies is very difficult.
Okay. Rosa Marie, for you.
For me, top of my list, again, be clarity of the subsidy. You know, parents need to know what's available to them, and it needs to be upfront and obvious. And then secondly, I would say the availability, you know, even from a provider standpoint, parents need to have that flexibility in their scheduling. Like, it needs to be built into your programming some way and somehow, because we know that the workforce is changing. The way that people are earning a living is changing. Very rarely, with us being millennials, it's not often that we're working 9 to 5 Monday through Friday.
It took me a while to figure out which version of a New York Easy Pass to get online. If that's not all that clear, imagine what parents thinking about subsidies and child care. I am not surprised to hear that it's difficult. Let me ask Bridget Chumway to grab the microphone. She's president of Generations Child Care. What is your view on how this, the current situation is for parents, for kids? What has changed, and what do you think the needs are most immediately?
Well, I think I'm going to start with the change in infant toddler care, if I can, which has been pointed out in the report from the Children's Agenda. So in the report, it's highlighted the impact of the universal pre-K in our community, as well as expanded pre-K. This is a great thing for 3- and 4-year-olds. Generations has 12 classrooms, 3 different contracts, Fairport School District, Rochester City School District, and directly with State Ed. These programs are fabulous for these children. What has happened, though, as Pete was alluding to, is that a lot of providers have given up their infant toddler classrooms in order to serve the 3- and 4-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They also are finding themselves challenged. When you look at the economics of taking care of infants and toddlers versus preschool and pre-K children, they are quite spread. They are much different. And I just brought a couple figures, if I might. I think it might help your listeners. So at Generations, the cost of care for an infant is actually $6,120 a year. For a preschool child, it's $14,560. So a little less expensive for a 3-year-old. However, here's what happens to providers. You can have 8 infants. You can have 16 preschool kids. So if you are lucky enough to fill that classroom, you have about $130,000 for those infants. You also have, in the other end, $232,000 for those 3- and 4-year-olds. Same staffing, same overhead, same need for materials, you know, paper products and so forth. So why are people giving up infant and toddler classrooms and slots in this community? Because economically, it's too difficult for them to make the numbers work. So there's more movement to taking care of the older children, where you can make your budget work, than those younger children.
For the providers, yeah.
For the providers, mm-hmm. Right. This is creating a problem for the parents who can no longer find openings for infant and toddler care. I mentioned I have six centers. On Monday, all of them were full. The infant rooms were full, and some of them had waiting lists. I learned the next day that a parent lost their job at one of the centers. You know, maybe there's one opening. So I have spoken with Pete, and one of the things I'd love to see this community do is use technology so that providers can put something out there letting parents know where are your openings, and they're not spending hours and hours trying to figure that out. As far as the subsidies, so Generations has been providing care for 27 years. We have about, I don't know, somewhere around 550 kids in our care right now, and just shy of 300 are receiving a subsidy. So we know quite a bit about subsidies for families. The struggles that they have, and both Sarah mentioned it, I think, is what's available, how to find out what's available. I'll give you one little story about a parent I worked with at my Fairport site. She was really, really a single mom, working at a bank, really struggling with the cost of care, $250 a week or whatever it was getting behind. And so I was speaking to her and I said, you know, have you tried to see if you qualify for a subsidy? She said, I went through that once before. I'm not going through it again. They denied me. It's not going to work and all that. And I said, I want you to call this person at WDI, right? I want you to look at that funding that goes beyond what the county does. At the time, maybe they were funding up to 160% of the poverty level. I said, if you will do that, even if they deny you, I will work out some way for you to pay, okay? But if you don't do that, I can't continue to give you care because mm-hmm. I got employees to pay, right? She went through that. She got $100 a week off her child care. But she kept her son at the center. She can afford the $150 versus the $250, and it made all the difference to her. But she first of all thought she wouldn't qualify. And, you know, as Sarah pointed out, she was with a provider who had enough knowledge to say, go here, do this. So I think that publicizing, you know, making sure that families know what's available is a really important point.
Let me read a separate email from a separate Sarah.
Okay.
That kind of maybe illustrates the question on infant care versus older kids. Sarah says, when our five-year-old was born, we easily found him a spot in a suburban child care center, paid more than $300 per week for care. We moved him to an RCSD UPK site last year, and our weekly cost was halved with only needing to pay for wrap care. He continues to attend the same site for kindergarten after school. When we found out we were expecting twins, born last February, we were able to get spaces in the same child care center as our older son. But infant care for twins would have been over $600 per week, and our overall monthly child care cost would be approximately three times our mortgage payment. That was enough that my husband and I questioned whether we could afford for both of us to work and have childcare for our twins. We spent my whole pregnancy searching for less expensive options, including babysitters on care.com and in-home daycares. There are almost no in-home providers in the southeast section of the city or in Brighton near my work. Those that did exist seemed not to have full-time slots for two infants. Luckily, we're able to find a wonderful licensed in-home center in a different city neighborhood whose rates are more affordable. Our twins are thriving there, but the process of finding childcare was a huge source of anxiety during an already difficult pregnancy. Does that ring a bell, kind of what you're talking
absolutely.
About? Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. So indicative there of some of the issues. And let me hit Pete DeBosny with a question that comes from a listener named Jane who says, wouldn't every family benefit from paid family leave that's offered by most of the industrialized world? There's no infant care crisis in Canada or most of Europe because families get a full year of paid leave. Some allow the parents to split the leave. Wouldn't this be a better way to care for babies and to give new parents real opportunities to bond with their children?
Well, so the short answer is yes. We do have paid family leave in New York State now. It's 12 weeks, which puts us kind of at the front of the a nation in terms of that. I don't think 12 weeks is enough. I think we should offer parents more opportunities for leave than that. The other thing that a lot of those countries have, though, is in addition to paid family leave and the ability to kind of split time on that and things like that is, you know, they have universal child care programs. So the cost of finding care for an infant, especially if you have twins, which is like, I mean, that's a staggering sum of money, right? But the cost of care for children in this country is borne by those parents. So in other countries, they have something like paid family leave, and they can take that time off to bond and to have that attachment with the child. And then when they choose to go back to the workforce, there's you know, the cost of care are at least partially you know, borne by us collectively, you know, as taxpayers, and that supports higher workforce participation. It brings more money into the economy. It allows employers to find folks to hire. So it's not just, there's a lot of benefits to having a more comprehensive approach to childcare. Whereas in the United States, we have this really, it's either kind of completely on you to have, you know, really considerable resources, or we have these child care assistance programs, these subsidy programs, which are, as our panelists have been talking about, incredibly tied to the time you're at work. And so if schedules change, or if hours get cut back, or if there's just these challenges in terms of someone's nearly full time, but they're not quite and they're part time, then it makes it really hard for those parents who are, you know, have those flexible work schedules, things like that, to find any kind of care option. So yes, we need to do paid family leave, and the Children's Agenda has championed that, and we helped, secure passage of that. But we need to do more than that. We need to have, accessible, affordable care for children throughout their early years.
So let's hit the agenda on the state and local levels after our only break. Pete Nabosny, Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda, is here. You just heard really the stories and testimony of three mothers kind of telling their stories of trying to find child care, trying to find affordable care, trying to balance work care and the best possible options for their families and their children. Bridget Shumway is president of Generations Child Care. We're going to take that break and come right back to these direct recommendations next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we sit down with students from the University of Rochester who discuss recent controversies on campus related to China, the Hong Kong protests, the status of Taiwan and Tibet, and more. Then in our second hour, Rochester City Court has a new housing section. Now tenants can bring small claims actions against landlords to be heard by a judge. How will it work? We'll talk about it Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So the Children's Agenda has put together, as they often do, their prescription for what can happen to help parents, to help kids. And the recommendations are at the state level and then at the local level. Let's start at the state. Four of them, Pete Nabosny. Let's go down that list. Go ahead.
Sure. So I think the big thing we're calling for, and we're not alone in this in New York State, but is for New York State to kind of put a stake in the ground and say that by 2028, New York State can achieve universal child care throughout the entire state. And that's going to take a series of investments over the years and putting money into every state budget. But to create a system where every parent who seeks out care for their children can find it, they can afford it, that care is quality, that there are certain standards in place for that. And I'll get into this in a minute, but in particular, parts of the state in areas with higher poverty rates and things like that, that there's sort of this universal access concept. So if you live in a higher poverty community, care is available as you need it. But the bottom line is that every year we need to be investing additional funds into things like the child care subsidy system, and then building beyond that, so that every family in the state can afford care, and providers and people who work in this field, which we haven't talked about at all, but the folks who are working with these children are among the lowest paid people in our community, and they do the most amazing work, and they should be compensated for it, and that should be valued in our society, that caretaking.
I want to just hit that point because, look, I mean, I'm going to put on my parent hat here. I think we all want the people who care for our kids when we can't be there to be paid really well for a lot of reasons. They deserve it. The work is hard. And you want them as invested as much as they can be. I mean, nobody is ever going to be as invested as a parent. But, boy, there's amazing people doing this work. And so for all of those reasons, I love the idea of paying them more. Now, do you have a sense for how much money we're talking on an annual basis if you're going to achieve goal number one there?
Yeah, we've been working with some different folks around the state, you know, it's going to take it, you know, people, it's big dollars, right? So it's a number of billions of dollars that it would take us to get to universal child care. But the way we've achieved that with other programs, I mean, we've gotten nearly to a $1 billion in pre-K funding over the last several years by just, you know, putting money into the state budget each year and building it out that way. We still have challenges funding our schools, but you know, we've added funds to foundation aid and other things each year. We need to start doing that towards childcare. You know, New York State has a, I don't know, 70-something billion-dollar budget, and it puts, you know, in terms of state dollars, a couple $100 million into childcare each year. And so, you know, it's a big price tag, but we can get there if we kind of put a stake in the ground and then start, you know, finding those funds and prioritizing it.
If you had sort of your policy priority hat on, because there's been talk at the national level about student loan debt forgiveness. Mm-hmm. If you could choose student loan debt forgiveness or universal child care, what should be the priority?
Well, I don't know. I think we need to do lots of things to help young people kind of succeed.
I'm trying to see how high this universal child care is on the list of what you think actually impact families.
Well, so what I'd certainly say is one of the biggest barriers, taking a step back, a lot of folks who are struggling with student loan debt, you know, that's a real challenge. Oftentimes, it's having a child when you have that student loan debt that is really what cripples someone's budget and prevents them from being able to achieve greater economic security. And in general, you know, the children's generation, we talk about this a lot, you know, the people most likely to be in poverty in our community are children and then the parents of those children, because children are expensive. They're not earning money for the household. They oftentimes do prevent parents from being in the workplace because of reasons we're talking about today. So if we were to do something like achieving universal child care, we'd, you know, we would see things like poverty reduction. We'd see things like having people have more capacity to pay down their student loans you know, achieve that kind of security. So I think there's lots of things that we need to do as a society, but you know, I'd certainly put something like universal child care right near the top of the list.
All right, I was going to call you Senator Nabozny because I thought you were dodging, but I think you did.
Not
here. I think you got to child care.
You know how to ask the questions.
It really matters. Number two, what's on the list? Number two.
So right now there's a New York State Child Care Availability Task Force, which has folks from all over the state who are involved in it, including my boss, the CEO of the Children's Agenda, Larry Marks, is on that task force, and it's responsible for issuing final recommendations by, you know, late next fall, early next winter, for next year's budget. And what we believe is that that task force, as it's putting forward these recommendations, hopefully to do something like achieve universal child care, that it prioritizes infant toddler care. You know, as Bridget said, the cost of caring for young children, very young children, is extremely high, and the economics of it just don't work for providers. And so that's why we're seeing something like a 25% reduction in infant toddler care in the city of Rochester over the last couple of years. So you know, taking care of that first, shoring up infant toddler care needs to be a real priority as the state makes these hope for investments over the years.
Number three.
So this is going to get a little wonky. So let's, you know, bear with me here. But New York State currently, the way that sets the subsidy rate is based on something called a market rate survey. So what happens every couple of years, the state surveys providers like Generations, like home-based providers, folks all over the state, and they ask what they charge for, you know, part-time care, full-day care, infants, toddlers, all the different age groups. And then they do a lot of statistical analysis, and they set what's called a market rate for care in different communities around the state. So Monroe County is grouped with Onondaga and Erie County and some other kind of larger counties in upstate New York. And what that does is it sort of captures the cost that providers are able to charge parents. And often that's not what the cost is to provide the care. And that's, again, what we're talking about with infant toddler care is they only charge what they know at some level a parent can possibly afford and that they can get kids into that room. And it doesn't come close to covering the cost of care. And so what we're calling for is for the state to consider maybe a hybrid, but at the very least replacing this kind of what's the going rate with what's the actual cost of providing quality care for very young children. And that would allow particularly not to digress a bit, but this problem of a real lack of infant toddler care, it exists particularly in low-income communities. In suburban locations, not to overly generalize, but providers will often operate that infant toddler room, or those infant toddler rooms. It's kind of like a loss leader. You know, a family enters care, they need a place for their kid to go, they pay for it throughout that time, that child's time, infant, toddler, preschool age, before, you know, at school, after school, that kind of thing. And that sort of, that works in the suburbs. So the provider sort of offsets their losses when the kid's very young with, they make a little money on it when the kid's 3 and 4. That just doesn't work in high poverty communities for a range of reasons we could get into. But part of it is the expansion of universal pre-K. Part of it's just sort of transportation challenges, instability of work, things like that. So shifting to this cost of care model, we think would allow more providers to offer infant toddler care, particularly in more stressed communities.
Okay, and finally, recommendation number 4 for New York State.
So this relates to kind of what I was just saying, that we do some really interesting things with different social policies, like the city of Rochester, kids who attend RCSD schools or live in the city of Rochester, we have something called like community eligibility for free and reduced lunch. So high poverty communities, kids who go to school in those areas, they don't actually ask them to kind of the families to prove that they that they're eligible for free reduced lunch. It's sort of just there's enough people that administratively it just makes sense to, if you live within this geographic area, you get free summer meals, you get lunch and breakfast paid for it at the district. We should think about doing something like that with childcare as well. High poverty areas, like there's enormous hoops families have to go through to secure subsidy to maintain it and to prove the earnings and all hours and things like that. And so we believe that we should look at this and take a step back and say, is the administrative cost of administering these programs worth it when we know that such a huge portion of families in a particular community probably qualify? And so extending that concept of community eligibility to a place like the city of Rochester, but also other areas that struggle from high poverty rates.
All right, so before I get everyone else's response to those recommendations, one follow-up here.
Sure.
We're 5 years or so into the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. One of the things we heard from the outset was we're too siloed as a community. It is too difficult, especially for people in poverty, to find the services they need, to know what they're eligible for, to get them in one place. Here we are, and we've got parents from different socioeconomic classes, parents who are struggling in poverty, parents who are not in poverty. They don't know what they're eligible for. They don't know where to get it. Why are we 5 years into this? I mean, is it fair to ask that question, or is it more complex than that, Pete?
Well, I think it's always fair to ask that question. I think the target of that question is really important, though. Most social policies, kind of public assistance policies, things like that, are governed by federal regulations and beyond that, state regulations. And then our local governments have some discretion, particularly, I'd add, over childcare subsidy policy. And that's something that we're really hoping the Bellow administration takes on. But in a lot of these areas, the things that folks have frustrations with, they're governed by federal rules. I was on your show a few months ago talking about SNAP, the changes that are happening with that. Those are policies at the federal level that are then impacting folks in this community. And so I think there is a lot we can do, and there's a whole effort to through our MAPI, through some systems integration work, things like that, to streamline these processes. But we're trying to patch up and connect together a system that, the cynical part of me would say is designed to make it difficult, but at the very least, it's a real challenge.
All right, let's go around the table of 4 recommendations for New York State. Rosa Marie Curtis, who is a mother of 2 and president of Marvelous Mind Academy. What do you make of what you just heard from the Children's Agenda there?
What I make of what I just heard is that, the recommendations I think are fair. I will say that. I think the expectation of achieving those by 2028, it's reasonable. You mentioned, that, hey, we're 5 years into this conversation. Why are we still talking about this? And we know that you know, what Pete alluded to is that the system sets us up to fail. Like, it's not something that we're supposed to be able to just push through and make change, push through and make change. Like, if you really want it, you're going to have to dig deep, and it's going to take a series of changes, which is also why I loved your question about, like, okay, so which is more important? Are we going to forgive the, you know, the debt for the people who went and sought higher education, or are we going to go forward with this universal childcare? And I don't think that we can make them mutually exclusive. I mean, I think that would be part of the system's change. If what the goal is to create economic stability, right? That's the whole conversation around anti-poverty initiative, is how do we get our community to a place of economic sufficiency where we're stable in that? These are parts of the pieces. These are pieces of that overall working collectively together, this puzzle that we're formulating. There was an allusion to the rate that child care workers make. Yeah. So again, Marvelous Mind Academy being born out of a mother's frustration and having worked in child care and not getting paid enough to afford the same level of care that I'm providing for my own child. So instead of allowing that frustration to say, okay, well, I quit. No, let's buckle down. How are we going to make a difference? When I was afforded the opportunity to receive the grant through the Participatory Budgeting Project, one of my commitments that I'm still holding true to this day is to pay a true living wage. So when you ask, well, what are we supposed to be paying these people? We start at $17 an hour because it's that type of economic stability that's going to allow them to catapult their lives and really make a change. And then they don't have to worry about, oh my gosh, I'm gonna get kicked off the system. I'm not gonna be able to get the assistance that I need. Life is gonna be harder because now I make $12 an hour. Mm-hmm. With 17, and that number was pulled from the study that MIT did on true living wage from Monroe County and what it takes to achieve that. Mm-hmm. So I love what the recommendations that are being made. I sat in on a conversation at Action for a Better Community when, was it Larry Marks? Came in and instructed us on the task force, which is why I was super excited about this opportunity to sit here and talk with you, Evan, because it was really appalling to me that none of this was mentioned at the State of the State. So why are you expensing dollars to have these conversations? You're pulling parents from the community, you're pulling providers out of their offices to have these conversations, and there's no need of moving forward on this?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just to let listeners know, I mean, there's recommendations for local policy, which you can find, and we'll link to it. We're focusing on the state first and really foremost today, largely because of what Rosemarie just mentioned. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of talk in the state of the, I guess nothing in the state of the state. So now the children's agenda is trying to recenter that. And so let me ask Katie Guti to take the microphone and tell us what you make of what you heard from Pete.
A lot of things. But let's start with your question, what should be the higher priority, student loan forgiveness or universal child care? That's a really, really complicated question. And there is no short, sweet, simple answer. And I don't expect us to come up with that right now. I will say, in my family, we are lucky enough that we do not have student loans to pay right now. Mm-hmm. If you consider that lucky, because we also don't have degrees to go with them. Child care is still an issue for us. So even if you were to pick one or the other, wipe out student loans, awesome. There's still people that work that have kids. A friend of mine was mentioning something last night in conversation that it seems as though it's becoming more and more difficult for people to want to work. I disagree with that statement as a whole because I want to work. I want to provide for my family. I want to be a productive member of society. And I'm not saying that being home a homemaker is not, because that's
sure
don't misunderstand me, but I understand what he was saying, that because there's so many hurdles and so many frustrations and so it's so many challenges, it becomes easier to just say, you know what, if I'm going to be broke and poor anyway, I'm going to be broke and poor and be the one staying home with my kids.
Yeah.
So
and we have people who work in child care providing who cannot afford child care for their kids,
exactly.
Which is a remarkable thing. About a minute, Sarah, go ahead, your thoughts there.
Well, first of all, with the student loan versus child care thing, I would choose child care over the student loan forgiveness personally, because I think, like with all these state recommendations too, they're all about affordable childcare. And if we don't have affordable childcare, people aren't going to be able to work to pay their student loans and things like that. So, but one thing that stuck out to me that he said was the going rate versus the actual cost of childcare. And I think that's something that isn't considered a lot in terms of subsidies and things like that, because childcare providers aren't able to make what the actual rate is, because they're trying to provide affordable care at some point. So it's also thinking about them and thinking about the money that they deserve to run these programs, mm-hmm. that comes down to the wages they're able to pay and things like that, and the actual cost of the classrooms. You know, for my subsidies, it's, you know, it's the same thing. If I'm just trying to get back on my feet after losing my job and I only need help for a few months, I can't get that because of all these other reasons. I'm not asking to, you know, be on this system for years and years and years, but if I want to get back on my feet, I don't get that help.
Let me ask Bridget to down our last 45 seconds or so. Go ahead.
Sure. I think that I read this morning the governor's looking to provide free SUNY tuition if your income is up to $150,000 in your family. I think if we can do that and provide a $7,000 benefit to a family, we should be able to figure out how to provide equally for children in the most important years, mm-hmm. some funding. And the other thing I would like to add is on the recommendations on the market survey, Pete is absolutely right. Providers give what they're charging, not what the cost is. And in doing so, they are limited in what they can pay their employees. And there is a real crisis in the community right now for keeping well-qualified employees in the field of child care.
That's Bridget Shumway, president of Generations Child Care. To the entire panel, thanks for sharing your stories and for doing what you're doing in this community and raising your beautiful families. Thank you for being here. Pete Nabosny is the Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda. Learn more about these recommendations for the state and then the local ones where, Pete? Where can people read more?
Go to thechildrensagenda.org and you'll find our report and executive summary and information on how to get to Albany on February 4th to advocate for this issue.
February 4th, they're going to Albany.
That's right.
And it's digestible. It's not just for the wonks. They'd love to see you there.
Yep, that's right.
Thank you, Pete. Thanks to the entire team, Megan Mack, Rob Braden. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.